This week on Behind the Lens. Local schools get their latest report cards from the State Education Department. Some schools make the grade. Others, like Harney Academy, will need a lot of work. Also, city budget talks get underway, and Louisiana voters approve two constitutional amendments. Their sponsor, Senator J.P. Morrell, speaks with us about Election Tuesday and the politics of our times. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
Educators and parents alike are digesting the latest school ratings report from the Department of Education. The ratings are the first with a new formula, and education reporter Marta Jewson has been combing through this data. We spoke with her Thursday after the report's release.
The state released school performance scores today, which everyone is always excited for, although it can have tougher consequences for some schools rather than others. What we are generally seeing across the board is a slight dip, I think, in average scores and or in average school letter grades. This year, the state is measuring school performance scores in a different way. They've added a new component, which is called student growth, and that measures how well students are doing year over year.
Okay.
So that now accounts for 25% of grades for schools, and I think what we're seeing is that is probably helping some lower achieving schools out. Because if their students are lower achieving, but their kids are still making gains, that's going to be reflected now as opposed to just static low achievement in the past, which would have reflected a lower score since those scores were just based on test scores.
Okay. What other factors are considered in these grades for the schools?
Generally speaking, K through 8, it's 75% test scores and achievement and 25% student growth. So growth is that new component that we were talking about. Experts think it's the best way to measure how a school actually affects students as opposed to test scores, because students all come in with different levels of knowledge. We actually did a nice big piece on that this week, so if you want to learn more about growth and how it's measured, you can check that out on The Lens NOLA.
And in fact, we will have the complete school grades for Orleans Parish Schools online at thelensnola.org as well. The impact, Marta, what happens to these schools that are getting the lower grades, the C and lower?
The C is pretty much, I'd say, a maintenance grade in our district, so you're probably not going to see too many consequences with that. Although there is a new, they're looking at segments of the population in schools now, so they are coming out and saying, hey, this school, you're not doing so well with kids with disabilities, or this school, you're not doing so well with low-income students, and you need to come up with a plan to fix that. And then for the overall grades, at schools where we're seeing D's and F's, that's where there are going to be some consequences. If you have an F and your charter is up for contract renewal, you are probably not going to get renewed. And if you have a D and your charter is up for its second contract renewal, you're probably not going to get renewed. These are consequences that are going to shake out over the next week. The Orleans Parish School Board meets next week, and that's when Superintendent Henderson Lewis will present his recommendations.
All right. Speaking of the OPSB superintendent, this week, Monday, he had a very controversial meeting with parents and staff at Harney Academy. What was said Monday night, and what is going on at Harney Academy?
Yeah, and Harney is really a kind of a special case because it's not one of those schools that it had an F rating, but it's a school that's had a lot of administrative problems. And so when Superintendent Lewis and his team came to the school on Monday night, I don't know if parents knew what was coming, but he pretty much right off the bat announced that the school was going to close. And this was coming off a tumultuous week for parents because the Friday prior to that, they had suspended Harney's principal, which I think was pretty unexpected. And parents really liked that principal that had recently been installed.
And the superintendent, Mr. Lewis, telling staff and parents, quote, "I've been an educator for over 20 years and I've never seen anything like this." And what we are talking about, as you report in detail in your writing, some of the allegations of financial mismanagement, looking at schools' bank statements sent to the church where the board president, Reverend Charles Southall, serves as pastor, some state education funding going to the pastor's home address in Baton Rouge, tens of thousands of dollars in employee retirement contributions being withheld. Just a few of the allegations. What are they doing now to adjust after some of these allegations?
The school has received a lot of warnings from the district that are related to everything you've said and more, including special education issues. They're addressing those problems through different trainings and paperwork review and working to close those loopholes or loops. But I don't think that's enough for the district. It sounds like they're still going to close down the school, which that really brings up this quandary of if you only have administrative problems at a school, and I'm not saying Harney only has administrative problems, but it seems to be largely administrative problems, do you still shut down the school? Because, you know, parents at that meeting said, I had no idea the school was going to close. I love the school. It's my neighborhood school. Why am I losing my neighborhood school?
Okay. And remind me, this is a C grade that Harney is?
Harney was a C, and as of today, they are a D.
They are a D at Harney. And I know parents have a lot of questions. You have, as I said, spearheaded a pretty impressive investigation here. What's next for parents? What are they saying, and what are some of their concerns?
Well, the parents just want to know where their kids are going to be going next year. Parents also want to know why their kids are going to the school if it's going to close in 8 months. You know, why does the school even open if it's going to be shut down? That really brings up issues with teacher retention and also student retention. And I did just want to let everyone know we're going to see some announcements rolling as we lead into the next week. And I just found out that parents at Cypress Academy received a letter from the district saying the district will no longer run that school next year. So those parents are waiting to hear who's going to be in charge of their school come Monday.
Education developments, courtesy the hardest working education reporter in New Orleans, Marta Juson. Thank you.
Thank you.
City budget talks are getting underway as we record this on Friday, November 9th. Lens writer Michael Isaacstein is covering the story at City Hall.
So starting on Friday and then through all of next week, the different city departments will be coming in to basically go before City Council and report on their budgets for the next year. So that City Council can evaluate what they should get. The things to watch out for are major increases to public safety. So one of the biggest revenue increases we see is pay raises for the police department. Also, the city is going to be losing $4 to $6 million in revenue because Mayor Cantrell is removing some of the traffic cameras, which she had promised to do in her campaign.
Michael, we were talking briefly earlier about the timing on this year's budget. It is Mayor Cantrell's first city budget, and a little more of a time crunch here. Can you explain that?
The city council needs to adopt a budget by December 1st of this year. In past years, city council has had about 2 months between the time that Mayor Landrieu submitted his proposal and the time they actually had to vote on a budget. This year, they're dealing with a much, much shorter timeline. Mayor Cantrell submitted her budget proposal on November 1st, which was the last day that she legally had to do that. So now city council only has 1 month to go through the proposal, ask questions, make amendments, make changes. And that leaves them a little bit crunch for time. As it stands now, they've scheduled to vote on the budget on November 29th. So we're coming up on it pretty fast.
Okay. And we'll be watching. Thanks to you, Michael Isaacstein, reporting for The Lens. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you've been listening to us for a few weeks now, you may recall our segments on two constitutional amendments up for a vote last Tuesday. Those are 2 and 6. 2 establishes a requirement for unanimous juries in felony cases. 6 puts a limit on how quickly property taxes may be raised after reassessments. Both of them passed on Tuesday, and the lawmaker behind both of those measures is the Democratic State Senator from New Orleans, J.P. Morrell.
It was interesting because there was so much public support and a lack of controversy regarding 2 that those who were opposed to two really had to resort to very non-traditional ways of fighting it. Though you never saw any ads against two, you saw a tremendous amount of work by DAs and sheriffs in areas that didn't like it to try to use word of mouth to generate support against it. I had a lot of reports. People were feeling very good about two going into Tuesday, obviously, but I started to hear a little bit prior, Thursday, Friday of the previous week, that people were literally showing up to the polls to early vote, an early voting period, against two. There wasn't much on the ballot, so they were literally show up to say, I'm here to vote against two, in areas like Bugaloosa, Hammond, those sort of areas. And so I had a lot of conversations with the advocates and groups that were proponents and said, listen, this is about voter education. If they know about what two's about and why it's bad, people will vote for it. If you don't educate them and you allow misinformation like voting for two lets criminals out of jail, then you lose voters. And I think that there were some efforts made by the advocates and those spending money to try and do more outreach in areas of the state they had lacked outreach in to make up for that. And I think that's what kind of, I think looking back at the numbers, two was always going to pass. The margin by which it passed was the statement.
In your view, what ultimately is the impact on neighborhood level of two?
I think the impact, what people don't understand, obviously non-unanimous juries are bad. The practice is not universal in the state of Louisiana. There are many DAs across the state that don't have split juries because they appropriately screen people for a crime. People are charged with the crime they actually committed versus the elevated crime to get to a split jury, and there's more equity and justice. And I'll give a great example I always give. In New Orleans, if you get arrested for two joints under the previous law, a DA should screen you into possession, simple possession. Two joints is personal use. Oftentimes, you'd be elevated to distribution, which is a felony, which would give you a non-unanimous jury. So you go from a six-person unanimous jury to a split jury. And what that will result in is if a DA could get a conviction under a split jury, a charge which should have had 6 months in jail turns into 8 to 25 years in jail. And so I think on the neighborhood level, what you're going to see is in most areas where they were using split juries as a crutch, they're going to have to appropriately screen cases and appropriately charge people. So this isn't going to lead, I think, overnight to people not going to jail or being charged with crimes. It's going to lead to more equity in that if someone's charged with a crime, it'll be an appropriate charge. And the difference for a 19-year-old African-American college student for having a misdemeanor on their record and potentially getting suspended 6 months in jail versus going to jail 8 to 25 years on a felony, that's a sea change as far as major urban areas and impact. So I think what you're going to see is DA offices that have used split juries as a crutch are going to have to really look at cases, screen them appropriately, appropriately charge people, and make decisions based on that. And that will be more equity under the law, which is what our founders of the Constitution, you know, they thought when they required there to be, for all practical purposes, unanimous juries.
If you would.
CA6 in a nutshell.
Basically, CA6 was an effort to provide some relief for people who are getting slammed with ridiculously high property taxes over a short period of time. Now, to be clear, and I've had to address this in a lot of different areas, CA6 was never a solution to gentrification. There's the types of solutions that have been on the been attempted for years, like doing an overall cap to property increases. Those are things that we've tried and will continue to try at the state level to try and provide some relief. What this was an effort to do, and the reason why I passed is because it was something I knew could get through the legislature to provide some immediate relief. And what it does is, when your property tax gets elevated above 50% in a given assessment periods are every 4 years, if it's above that 50% threshold, it has to be phased in over 4 years. So for example, if your taxes go up from $500 to $1,000 over one assessment period, they would have to break up that new $500 and increase it in 25% increments over a four-year period. So though you'd be faced with a tax increase, that could be the difference between, can I afford to live in my house? Do I have time to figure out if I can rejigger my budget to stay in my house? Or if it simply doesn't work, I have the ability to make a conscious decision as to whether or not I want to sell, and it'll be on my terms, not as a fire sale to avoid a city lien. And what I the complaints I heard from my constituents were, I'm getting slammed with the property tax. Overnight, I have to decide when I'm moving and how I'm going to get from under the house. That practice and that behavior really benefited those out-of-state Airbnb investors who would then go buy the house they priced someone out of at a cheaper rate because that person was trying to get from under it before their taxes got them. And I mean, it's not a solution to gentrification. It's not ideal. For those people who were disappointed that it was even there, what I would tell them and what I've told them is, if your choice is, can you give some relief to people until we find a solution, I will always choose giving them some relief versus no relief because I couldn't get what I wanted. Furthermore, when it comes to property tax, people forget this all the time. The state really does not collect property tax. We don't benefit from property tax. Property tax is a local issue. Local governments set the millages, set what the property tax levels are, and local government is based off property tax. Specifically, the city of New Orleans under a home rule charter, we really can't tell the city of New Orleans what to do with property tax. What we can do is provide relief, and this will not just affect Orleans Parish. St. Charles Parish has a similar increased problem, but for different issues. In St. Charles Parish, because of the huge influx, the oil and gas boom there, they have a shortage of housing stock, so people are moving into Lake Charles from Beaumont, from Houston, and because the property values are so high in those areas, they're willing to pay a higher premium for a home. And there was a lot of support from the Lake Charles delegation to help pass this legislation, but it was really like doing surgery with a sledgehammer. Basically, trying to address this issue was not elegant, but when you're faced with constituents who just need some help, you just got to kind of do what you can do.
Peter Horges.
I'm sure you saw our exchange.
I certainly wanted to give you an opportunity to at least respond. His column in The Lens, titled Proposition 6 is Deeply Flawed, Hold Your Nose and Vote for It Anyway, complains that essentially this is just spreading the pain as a slow burn, if you will, and not helping people, for instance, shy of that 50% mark.
Right. And the thing is that honestly, a lot of Peter's criticism is in fact correct, because I have the same concerns he does. Where he and I diverge is one, this hold your nose and vote for it. When I saw that, it was infuriating. That's like going to a homeless person and offering them food and them saying, hell no, I want a fiver. The reality is, my goal was to provide some relief to people where no relief was previously sought. My frustration with his article was he talks about the ceiling, the ceiling cap, as if no one had considered it, when in fact, we've been fighting for that for years with no traction. This is kind of a lesson for all opinion writers and all journalists. If you're gonna write an article about a topic, you need to do more research than reading other stories. Had he bothered to talk to anyone in the legislature about the flat ceiling, he would have known it's been tried and it's been unsuccessful. So the fact that he kind of alleges we didn't consider it, we've been fighting for that and we failed. This was an opportunity in the interim until we get some traction on that to provide some relief. As far as his argument where he talks about wasting political capital and how we wasted too much time on this, I would counter for someone staring down the barrel of losing their home, no time is wasted in trying to provide some relief. In regards to renters, when you talk about the state's limitations on how we can interact with property tax, we cannot provide relief to renters. The biggest push I got back and why this legislation almost failed was that without the homestead exemption requirement, there were a lot of concerns, including by advocates in New Orleans, that without a homestead exemption requirement, the same Airbnb investors that are buying up property would then utilize this to freeze their property tax. So the homestead exemption requirement was specifically put in there, A, to combat assessors who said that there'd be widespread fraud, and B, to make sure that commercial interest couldn't use this legislation as they're kicking people out of their rental property to then freeze their property tax.
I want to move to the rest of the Tuesday vote, if you don't mind. But for one thing, general thoughts coming out of Tuesday's elections here in the state.
In the state of Louisiana, I think people as a whole had unrealistic expectations. I think that you have to look at a victory. You have to look at a victory in Louisiana through the lens of the Beto O'Rourke election in Texas. A lot of people were heartbroken that Beto couldn't pull it off. I would argue Beto probably knew going into it wasn't going to pull it off. What did happen is that in Texas, they flipped 5 House seats to Democrats because the turnout Beto corrected. I think that when you look in Louisiana, if you're a progressive and you're looking for movement, change in Louisiana is glacial. That's how slow. I mean, it's like icebergs moving through water slow. If you look at how many people voted, the turnout in Louisiana in a midterm election, it was tremendously higher than previous midterm elections. The districts in which people were competing have been gerrymandered so thoroughly, you are not necessarily ever going to see the results you would like. The challenge for people and what they have to understand is, if you are a new voter energized by this past cycle, the thing which people who disagree with you are terrified of is that you vote in 2019 during the legislative races. That is where, if you want to see change happen, we're going into redistricting in 2020. If you're someone who really wants to affect the future of the state of Louisiana, that begins by having fairly drawn districts that are not gerrymandered to one party or the other. If you are a new voter who voted in 2018 and you go vote in 2019, that is the number one issue where you can have an impact, because you should be looking for candidates that A, represent your values, but B, are going to help draw districts that are fair, where voters are not diluted in their strength. So I am excited, not only by the results, but by the turnout, because if that turnout is reflected also in the governor's race and the legislative races, that could have a tremendous sea change outcome on politics in the state of Louisiana.
Okay. Now, Secretary of State's going to a runoff. Gwen Collins Grant, $1,500 she spent?
Well, the when you look at statewide elections, there is a trend. Democrats, on average, a Democrat in a statewide race, if there's a single Democrat, usually averages about 30 to 35% of the vote, as far as mm-hmm. voters who vote Democrat. Yeah. If you add Fought Not Free to Ms. Greenup, together they're 35% of the vote. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard. Democrats who vote in statewide elections look for a D to vote for. You had 2 Ds on the ballot. I hate to sound practical, but the winner was higher up on the ballot than Fought Not Free.
Sure.
So I think when a lot of people were going in to vote for their local elections, to vote for Amendment 2, they saw a Secretary of State race. Not a lot of money was spent, generally speaking, so people were unfamiliar with almost all the candidates.
Right.
I mean, unless you're in the Baton Rouge area, they knew who Kyle Ardoin was. You had a couple of electeds and former electeds. In Jefferson Parish, there was Julie Stokes. In the North Shore area, there was A.G. Crow. In the other Baton Rouge area, there was Rick Edmonds. But everyone else, if you weren't known regionally, you weren't known at all.
Right.
And I think that she benefited from being higher on the ballot. She benefited from there being a very high turnout. And I think that put her in a good position. Whether that results in a victory at the end of the day, being a Democrat running statewide is always a uphill climb. That isn't a reason not to run, but people who want to be successful in statewide politics, if you want to be successful in this state, until we get to a point where many of the people who choose not to vote get to a voting position, you have to pretty much adopt the John Bel Edwards model. That's the only model to get elected in the state of Louisiana, because as long as Republican votes outnumber Democrat votes on a statewide level, I hate to sound cynical, and I guess as term limits make you cynical, but someone who's a dedicated Republican, it's very difficult to vote Democrat. You have to really have a compelling candidate who they feel supports their value system, which is what John Bel was able to do. I think that running statewide as a Democrat, and I certainly hope we field Democrats in every statewide race in the gubernatorial cycle, because a lot of money will be spent both locally and nationally to affect that race. The reality is, and this is a problem, an absolute criticism of the state party and how they're going to restructure for 2019. Democrats, other than John Bel Edwards, who's kind of the aberration, are at that 30-35% cap. And the challenge becomes, even if you're someone who's, I'll give you a great example, the Caroline Fayard race. Caroline Fayard spent a tremendous amount of money, and I think she didn't break 40%. And I think with the party, until the party figures out what they're going to be, the challenge they are facing, I'm saying this as projectively because it's not JP, this is a perception JP has of the state party. Okay. They're trying to evaluate, we don't have as many resources as the Republican Party. We don't have as much money. When we're going to make a big spend, we have to be able to justify it to say that it grows the base or grows the party. As a party with limited resources, do you continue to compile them for the major 2019 election, or do you spend a tremendous amount of money if you have polling showing the ceiling still in place? Because the reality is that our party is not as well funded as the Democratic Party of California or New York or any of these other coastal states. In fact, our party is pretty, on the fundraising side, they do well considering where they're at, but they don't have a lot of resources. So they have to kind of make almost Sophie's choice decisions of, do we go all in on somebody and spend resources so that, for example, a lot of new people, a lot of new candidates who are running for legislative office in 2019, they're going to be wholly dependent on the party for resources. And that's got to be spread across 105 House seats and 39 Senate seats. If you spend a lot of money in an off election where polling says the person is going to get a certain cap, do you want to spend money on that race and not have money for the races in 2019? That's kind of the challenge they face. I mean, it's not ideal. It's kind of sad. But when you have limited resources, they're just doing triage.
That's J.P. Morrell, Democratic Senator from New Orleans. We want to thank you for listening this week. And while we've got your attention, we want to ask, do you know any musicians in New Orleans or the metro area? How about musicians with some original recordings? If you'd like to hear some of that original music on this podcast, why don't you drop us a line? We'd love to promote some great music from right here in the Metro New Orleans area. Any style, any genre will do. Look for the contact page at thelensnola.org or send an email to editor@thelensnola.org. And don't forget, readers and listeners like you make this public interest nonprofit news site possible. So consider a donation today at support.thelensnola.org. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting behind the lens.